family, relationships, and personal growth. Professional counselor Julius Dudix is here to help. Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
We have seen significant anger and fear coming out of the pandemic period. So even just that alone would be enough to cause this problem. But we actually date the rise of mass attacks and domestic terrorism to 2015. There's a lot of good data that tells us that we are increasingly lonely. We're increasingly more angry. We certainly have been living in an age of fear. Our media is dominated by outrage and fear. Our politics are dominated by that as well.
You're hearing from a national leader who actually used to serve in the Trump administration following the massacre, the Texas shooting over the weekend that happened outside of a mall, killing several people. Why we're seeing an uptick in mental health cases, but also mental health being probably one of the biggest issues in these mass shootings. And you heard it right there that unfortunately, especially in the last couple of years since the pandemic, people are online more and more. They live in a social media world more than they do in reality. And so we wanted to, during May, Mental Health Awareness Month, talk about the impacts of social media when it comes to anxiety, for example, and how much is too much consumption. Julius Dudix back with us today, our morning show counselor, to tackle this. Hey, Julius, how are you?
Good, Melissa. Thanks for having me back. Yeah, I love Mental Health Awareness Month because it really raises our awareness of the need to really take care of ourselves and take care of our thinking, which drives our feeling, which drives our behavior. So, yeah, it's those types of mental illness. We've talked about the mood disorders, depression. Today we're talking about anxiety. There are psychotic disorders, substance abuse disorders, personality disorders. Yeah, but it's all about recognizing, what am I doing and why I'm doing what I'm doing, and specifically anxiety and social media. It's that, have you ever heard of FOMO, FOMO?
FOMO, of course, fear of missing out, absolutely.
Yeah, that emotional response to the belief that you know, people are living better, people have more satisfying lives, perhaps missing out on opportunities. That really drives one to really spend an inordinate amount of time on social media, that FOMO syndrome.
What do you also think, Julius, about what you just heard the woman saying, that it is causing a lot of fear as well in people? It's also triggering emotions that maybe they don't typically feel, again, fear or anger, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. The more you feed on it, the more you put it in your brain, it's almost like FEAR does trigger fear, that the false expectation that appears real, because then your brain begins to make up things, and you hear about a shooting in Texas and you think, oh, no, what's going to happen next? And you begin to fixate on that event. Mm-hmm. And that affects how you feel about going to Trouble Mall or going to Westbrook or anything else. And that could end up paralyzing you. The longer you cultivate these types of thinking, the harder it is to uproot them. So you really want to recognize them and ask yourself, hey, what am I doing in terms of social media? Am I balanced?
You know, I'm curious, Julius, our morning show counselor, Julius Dudix, here talking about the impacts of social media on your mental health. My husband deleted all of his social media accounts. He deactivated them in the new year. And we were just talking about this over the weekend because my sisters were saying, you know, why don't you ever answer any of our messages, Derek? We send you messages on Instagram. You never answer. He said, I haven't had a platform on Instagram in almost 6 months. And they said, why did you do that? And he said, because I couldn't tell if I was on my platforms more than I should be. So I thought as a social experiment, I would get rid of all of them. He said, and it turns out I have never felt healthier. At least, like I had not felt this healthy since I was a kid and there was no such thing as social media. So my question, Julius, is maybe that's not ideal for a lot of people, which is to just delete everything. I know, unfortunately, for my line of work, we can't delete everything. But how can you detect in yourself if you are over-consuming, you're doing it just the right amount? How do you know that? How do you see the signs that, whoa, this is impacting me in a negative way?
That's a great question. Yeah. Well, I think it rolls back to your thought energy, because everybody is given the same amount of thought energy during the day. And if you're dwelling too much on social media, if you're thinking about it, if it's, again, we always roll back to sleep, appetite, exercise, you know, those types of things, your routine. Is it affecting those areas of your life? But are you thinking about it? And you and I both know your husband got to a place where he said, hey, I'm just reflecting upon it too much. It's having too much power and control over my day-to-day activity, and I'm being consumed by it. And, you know, you sent me an article, and in preparing for this, and in that article, it says when it comes to health and well-being, what you put in your head is as important as what you put in your mouth. And that's so true. If you continue to consume social media, especially negative social media, there's not a lot of room for anything positive. And so you're walking around with your brain, your cup is filled with all this negative shootings and negative, you know, Ukraine and negative earthquakes and everything. And there's nothing available for anything positive. Mm-hmm. And so that's why you need to kind of throttle back and ask yourself, like your husband did, you know, hey, am I better off if I go without it?
Mm-hmm. And Julius, I mean, we haven't even talked about screen time in general, whether that's social media, computers, television. Yeah. Julius Dudix is here during Mental Health Awareness Month, which is the month of May. And we're talking about the effects of social media on your mental health. But I also wanted to talk, Julius, about screen time. That could be your computer, your phones, your television even. What about the impacts of screen time on people, not just children, but people?
Yeah. Well, it again rolls back to that the way the brain is structured. You know, you've got your neurotransmitters and receptors and so forth, and you've got these carb channels that can get so used to screen time, and it's almost like you can become addicted to screen time, because what happens is dopamines are released, those feel good chemicals, and it almost is like I need it. But my biggest concern, I've been in education and counseling for over 40 years, excessive screen time just takes away a kid's ability to get outside and play and just to enjoy. And I love my wife because she teaches nursery school, and she'll just get a hose out and, you know, the kids will make muddy puddles and just play or climb trees or just run in the backyard. And I think we're losing that in so many families. So, yeah, that's a huge concern I have. You kind of inhibit your child's ability to really go outside and play. But then there's the issue of screen time and obesity. And the more TV or the more screen time is, you're snacking and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It could affect your sleep, especially if you're looking at the blue lights, you know, before bed. It could even affect your ability to kind of do your homework and such. And every parent, every family battles with, I think, screen time and video games. And it's almost like kids feel like they've talked their parents into thinking, I need it, when really you don't. And the best thing a parent can do is to teach moderation. But at the end of the day, when you come home and you're tired, it's so easy to let your child just go play a video game. And this way they're out of your hair and you can just kind of chill. So
I think part of that, Julius, is because we forget what our past looked like. I mean, when you think about today's parents, you're talking about their childhood was even 20, 30, 40 years ago. I know over the weekend we were up visiting friends in Rhode Island, and we spent 3 hours outside, you know, playing, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, whatever, with the two kids. And our husbands came home because they were at a function. And when they got home, they were like, you guys were outside all day. And we said, yeah, like they're 4-year-olds. What else are we going to do with them? And they thought, well, like, did you guys ever take a breather and like just put them in front of a video? And we're like, no. But again, I think that's because most parents almost forget, well, when we were growing up in the 80s and 90s, there were no computers. We had no computers. I remember taking typing classes in middle school, Julius. I remember learning how to type in sixth grade. Yep. Like, that was a phenomenon. So we always played outside. And it's not like parents are more tired today than they were 30 years ago. I just think we've become so accustomed to the world of technology that we forget that our parents didn't have the options of, let's just put the kids in front of an iPad or a television or a phone or whatever. It was, you know, they had to be outside and you played with your neighborhood friends and like there was more community there and there was more connecting as children. That's just not the reality that we live in. And I think we as adults forget that, let alone, you know, we always blame kids for being addicted, but they learn this at a very young age. I mean, you can only blame kids so much when you've got parents handing phones to them at one saying, here, you want to look through pictures? You want to learn how to slide the screen? You want to, you know, like they, you can only blame them so much if that's what they grew up in, if that's the model that's in their household. So
absolutely.
I don't know. I think you bring up a lot of great points, Julius. And if people wanted to talk to you about this or any other type of mental health issue that they may be struggling with or they want to get your input on, what is your website?
It's N as in Nancy, J as in John, cc.online. You can contact me there or you can call 203, call the office, 203-243-7714. But Melissa, the longer you cultivate a behavior, the harder it is to uproot it. Mm. And the bottom line is you just got to get honest and say, hey, how do I get rid of social media anxiety? If indeed you have it, you've got to acknowledge first. And then you've got to maybe try to take a break. If you can't go a day without looking at social media or without posting, maybe there's a significant problem there. You got to grab it. But everybody needs balance and nobody's perfect. And we all do. I'm not saying do away with it, but I'm just saying manage it better. Mm. And if you're not managing it better, there are people out there who can help you manage better. But the first thing, you got to get honest and you got to say, is this affecting me? Is this affecting my quality of life, my relationships? Am I spending too much time just vegging in front of social media? Because to your point, 20 years ago, what did we do when we got home? Dad read the paper and, you know, mom cooked and all that kind of stuff and Leave It to Beaver and everything. But, you know, we've been just hijacked by social media. Our brains have.
Yeah,
so,
certainly.
It's all about balance. All about balance.
It is. And certainly something Julius says every single week, because it always relates to pretty much what he says is don't stay stuck. But it's true, Julius.
Yeah,
if I could have just taken a picture of my sister's faces when my husband's like, I deleted all my, they were like, what?
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, you know what? But if we all did something like that, it's not forever, but it's just saying, hey, let me just see how big of an issue it is. And you may be surprised. My husband's never gone back and he doesn't think he ever will. And I think I'm so envious of you.
One day a week. Just start one day a week.
Yeah.
Trying to just stay away from it. See,
it's true.
You can't do that. And if you can't, then maybe there's a problem. But anyway.
Very true. Very true. Julius, I love having these conversations. I can't wait to dive into something next week. Thank you.
Sounds great, Melissa. We'll talk to you then.
All right. Julius Dudix here on WICC. You've heard it in our news today that Connecticut State Police are putting out a warning, especially as the temperatures rise. We're seeing more and more motorcycles out on our roads, but unfortunately, we're seeing a lot of crashes as well. And this past weekend, unfortunately, we've seen several deadly motorcycle collisions claiming the lives of riders. And so we want to make sure that we can have a more cohesive roadway between drivers and riders. And so this morning, we actually are connecting with somebody who should be a familiar voice to you. We had Luis on months ago of Two Brothers CPR here in Connecticut. In fact, he was my CPR certification instructor months ago, and I'm very grateful for that. But also, Luis apparently is part of a firefighter motorcycle club. So he's got some insight into motorcycle safety and joins us now with the details. Hey, Luis, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Good morning. I'm pretty good. How about you?
I'm doing fine. I'm glad to have you here. First of all, what club are you a part of?
It's called Fire and Iron. We're throughout the United States. We also have some clubs overseas.
Cool. So are you a motorcycle operator, rider?
Yes. I ride a 1,000-pound motorcycle.
Wow. Okay. Now, Luis, I had you actually weigh in on the show last week when we first were bringing up that the spring season was coming, and it was in my news, kind of a generic, hey, you know, drivers, be careful of riders, riders, be careful of drivers, so on and so forth. And you gave us a lot of great insight, so I was glad you could come back on the show in such short notice. Tell us some of the most common things as a rider you fear when you're out on the roadways here in Connecticut.
For some reason on the highway, people are always looking for, like, if they're going to merge left or right, they're always looking for a car. I don't think they're looking for a motorcycle. And our motorcycles are big, but yet they're narrow. So when you look, you may not see that white item. And because we're narrow, you don't see it either. So it requires a double check. You know, turn, you know, use your mirror, but also turn your head and look.
What are some misconceptions people have about motorcycle riders? Because you actually corrected me on the air last week, and I was really thankful for that because it was sort of a generic statement I had made, which is, hey, don't be one of those motorcycle operators who just goes up the middle of the, you know, the highway when we're in dead stop traffic and there's an accident ahead, or going down on the breakdown lane. And you had sort of clarified, like, hey, there are going to be riders who break the law because they're just being jerks, but there are a lot of riders who are doing that out of safety. Tell us about some of the misconceptions drivers may have about motorcycle operators.
So this is called lane splitting. Believe it or not, lane splitting is legal in a lot of the states. It's not legal in Connecticut, but it's legal in a lot of states.
Mm.
And what it does, it allows you to go through the vehicles, not zigzagging, but going through the vehicles at a certain speed, which is usually about 35, if there's traffic. Okay. So we also have to understand motorcycles. So it's easy to complain about or criticize about something, but once you understand the item, then it becomes easier to understand why. So most motorcycles are automatic. They're manual. They're not automatic like vehicles. So we have clutches, we have a brake with our foot, we have a brake with our hands. So there's a lot of moving parts to when it comes to motorcycles, okay? And what happens is these motorcycles, they require air going through them to be able to stay at a working temperature. So in other words, not to overheat. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
When we're in stop and go traffic, a lot of motorcycles start to overheat. The clutches will overheat, the brakes will overheat, and the motors themselves will overheat.
What happens when it overheats, Luis?
So when my brakes overheat, when I actually apply the brakes, they're not working 100% anymore. They're actually sliding on the brakes, not applying properly anymore.
Oh, wow.
If I'm going to take, say I'm at a full stop and my clutch is overheating and I'm going to take off, it doesn't take off right away. It struggles to take off.
It like stalls.
Yes. Okay. So there are problems with motorcycles that if we don't keep, and I don't mean speeding, I mean, but if we don't keep cruising, we'll have problems with our bikes.
Wow. I also imagine, though, Luis, it's very hard for you to stop a bike in manual compared to when you have an automatic car.
And yes, because they are lighter and we only have two wheels and they're very small wheels compared to a vehicle tire. When we slam on our brakes, because don't forget, we do not have ABS. So when we slam on our brakes, it's not as easy as control as a regular vehicle. So you'll see sometimes that the back wheel will start, you know, to sway back and forth. And that's when we're slamming on the brakes. So if you have to completely go from, say, 60 to zero, we're not making it. We're not doing it.
Wow, that's amazing. And again, we're talking to Luis Valbuena, who you know from having him on months ago. He came on the show to do his two brothers' CPR, talking about CPR certification, the importance of knowing this at a very young age, and of course through adulthood. But we also learned that Luis is in a firefighter motorcycle club that is across the nation, including here in Connecticut, and just sort of teaching us some of the basics. If you're not a motorcycle rider, like I am not. I've been on a motorcycle. In fact, I enjoy it very much whenever people offer a ride. So, Luis, I'm going to be tapping you for that soon. But sure. I have never operated one myself. And I have to say, just from learning those couple of things, Luis, I'm going to be thinking differently as a driver when I get upset and I think, why am I sitting here in 2 hours of traffic, but the motorcycles get to just breeze on through? I will think differently about that. So thank you for that. I am curious, though, why wouldn't Connecticut pass a law, if this is something overwhelmingly that's passed in other states, why not allow the, what'd you call it, the split highway, or what is it called?
Split lane.
Yeah. Why wouldn't we have that as a law here to allow motorcycle operators to be able to do that legally?
Tell the truth, I don't know, but maybe we should bring it up at the club.
I think we should.
Get all together and do it.
Yeah, I think we should. That's interesting.
I work in Stanford. I live in Bridgeport, so I'm on the highway every day. I'm on the Merritt. And how many accidents do you see daily?
I see them every day.
That's between one car and another car. Now imagine a motorcycle in between those two cars.
You're done. I hate to say it, but you're finished. It's like saying, you know, a moose versus a vehicle. The moose wins every time. I can't imagine the motorcycle winning ever, really.
Yeah, so which is why we do not want to stay in traffic where the guy behind me is going to fall asleep or is going to, you know, not realize, hit the gas and crash it between me, sandwich, and then the other vehicle.
Mm. This is worth bringing up to lawmakers, especially because there's so much attention this week in particular about motorcycle safety. We should definitely bring this up.
Yeah. And another thing that there are cultures, okay, when it comes to motorcycles. And believe it or not, the style of the motorcycle you ride is a different culture. You will probably never see a guy with a Harley-type motorcycle doing 100 miles splitting lanes. On the other bikes, you'll see them. So there is also a culture, and I'm not excusing any bike to, like I said, fine. We don't want to be in traffic. We're going to go through the middle or through the emergency lane, but at a reasonable speed. So I'm not excusing any bad behavior. So please, no one take me wrongly for what I'm saying.
No, I think you're making a lot of sense, Louise, which is that you can't put everybody into one basket. There are really responsible motorcycle operators, like there are drivers, and then you have people who push their limits, like drivers. We have the same problem, I would think, culturally with, that's why we have such a problem on Connecticut roadways, is because we have people who are impatient, switching lanes constantly. I mean, we have just as many problems, I would think, with regular vehicle operators as what you're talking about, which is the culture, the outlook of motorcycle operators. They're not all punks on bikes, essentially, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Yep. And then another main concern that drivers need to be aware of and need to be patient is, believe it or not, a dead squirrel on the road is enough to make us lose control of our bikes. So what I mean by that is we usually try to leave a space, a good amount of space, maybe 2, 3, 4 cars in between my motorcycle and the car in front of me. That's because obviously I cannot see ahead of the vehicle that's in front of me. I need to know I'm trying to see beyond, right? But because I cannot see beyond, I need to see between you and me. Now, sometimes you'll be driving and a car in front of me will pick up a rock, to pick up garbage, could pick up anything and make it fly into the air. Mm. I'm behind you, okay? So that space between me and the other vehicle is very crucial. It's not because I'm lazy. It's not because I'm going slow. No, it's my safety zone. So for the guy that's behind me, that space is itching and it's itching and he needs to be able to go around me and cut me off, you didn't gain anything other than put me in danger.
Mm-hmm.
Well, which is why we try to ride onto the side of the vehicle. In other words, we try to either ride to the center lane or to the left lane, because I want to be able to make sure that I can get out on the way on time, just in case there's some sort of debris on the road, a pothole. I cannot see in front of you. So if there's a vehicle, if I hit a pothole, okay, maybe I need a new wheel. But if I hit a big pothole on a motorcycle, I'm losing control of my bike.
You might flip the bike. You know, and Luis, again, that is something in Driver 101. We should be making space. We're supposed to have 2 car lengths between each car, and we don't do that. So beyond what you need as a motorcycle operator, we should be doing that even with vehicles. So the fact that we don't do it with motorcycles, it is just unacceptable. So I think that's another really great point, is that we're not talking about people who are texting and riding their motorcycles, because that'd be almost impossible. We're talking about they're trying to stay safe. So don't cut them off. Don't just assume that it's all this space and they're just being lazy. That's not what's happening. Luis, I want to thank you so much. We have run out of time, but definitely appreciate your insight this morning. As I mentioned, as a driver of just a regular motor vehicle, I learned a lot, and I definitely will be thinking differently whenever I see motorcycles, especially in traffic on the highway. So thank you so much for the insight.
No, thank you.
I appreciate your time. This story has been national news since last month. A fast-acting 7th grader who saved his school bus after his driver passed out. This has been such a huge story. It did not happen right here in Connecticut, but it was here in the U.S. where this young boy knew what to do in Michigan when he could see his school bus driver was unable to continue driving. He jumped up out of his seat, went over to the controls, was able to stop the bus, and then yelled to his other peers to call 911, being called a hero, of course. And we learned earlier this week from our national news outlets that How could he know how to do that? And we learned it was simple. He's been watching his father drive. He's been very attentive whenever he's in the car, specifically with his father, watching how he operates any vehicle. And I thought this spoke so much truth to something we talk a lot about with Fran Mako of AAA, as well as Cindy Iodice of the Flagman campaign, the importance of a passenger in any vehicle, no matter how young you are. So Fran Mako is here to comment on this and to continue the conversation here on WICC of AAA. Hey, Fran, how are you?
Very good. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. What do you think about this story?
Well, I think that seventh grader is an very unusual boy. I don't know how many, if most seventh graders would have the wherewithal or even the maturity or even the awareness to do what he did.
Mm-hmm.
Most seventh graders, and, you know, I haven't been in school in years, I don't know if they pay attention to what's going on, but this particular boy modeled, I suppose you can say that, what he had seen in his own car.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically is an example, I want to say an extreme example in a good way, of being an active passenger.
Right. What does that mean to be an active passenger, Fran? I know we've talked about it on the show, but for people who have never heard of that term.
It's someone who can help a driver identify the risks, the issues on the road. He's not a backseat driver. It's not someone who criticizes and nags and does everything negative, but it's someone who maintains the awareness around him and basically acts as a co-pilot to the driver. And it could be a child. It could be another adult. There's been a lot of research that says, you know, when it comes to driving safely, we all focus on what the driver should and shouldn't do. But there's something to be said about being an active passenger.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, a lot of research indicates, especially for teens, that passengers could be distractions.
Mm-hmm.
But on the positive side, passengers could also identify issues on the road that the driver may not see because there's so much going on behind the wheel when you're on, especially on Connecticut roads.
Yeah, well, and this is something we're talking to Fran Mako of AAA, that Cindy Iodice of the Flagman campaign, the founder of it, she started presenting this in the last few weeks in Fairfield schools as young as elementary. And one of the common questions I got from listeners is, why even bother presenting this to elementary or even middle school students when they're leagues away from getting their license? And the reason being, both you and Cindy said, is because this is, you're never too young to be an active passenger, to identify things, to be aware of the road, to understand what it means to be a responsible vehicle operator. And so I love that this story came out literally right around the time that Cindy started going into schools in Fairfield and presenting this pilot program, because it speaks, I think, so much to it. Like, will we see a lot of 12-year-olds doing what this little boy did? Probably not. But I do think it's a great concrete example of, here's a kid who's watching what his father does and knew how to react. And I think it also speaks truth, Fran, to how we as adults need to be aware of our actions. So if you're someone who texts and drives, for example, you probably want to stop doing that because your kids in the back seat are picking up on those bad habits.
That's right. That's right. In Cindy's case, for folks that don't know, she's focusing on a state law called Slow Down, Move Over. And drivers need to slow down when they see people, emergency responders, on the side of the road helping disabled motorists, and if possible, move over. And her whole program aimed at the elementary school population was to show them, you know, how you should be slowing down and moving over. Now, granted, they don't drive, but if they feel that their parents are going a little too fast in work zone areas, the child could remind the parent, there's Flagman, the picture of Flagman on mm-hmm. on the banners or the signs that are on the roadway. You have to slow down. It's just one more example of being an active passenger.
Mm-hmm.
My as an aside, my son, who's 24, he got his license very late. I was amazed how good a driver he is. Now, he is 24. He is inexperienced. He's a bit, emotionally inexperienced compared to older folks. But I was amazed his abilities on the roadway. And a lot comes from watching us drive, because I'm not really a crazy driver. You know, I can't.
I mean, I don't think you can be, Fran. I think it's literally in your contract. If you work for AAA, yes, you have to be an ideal driver, I would hope.
But the other thing, too, I am amazed at his eye-to-hand coordination from video games.
That's interesting.
You know, driving cars in video games.
Interesting.
And sometimes when he's a passenger, he'll turn to me and he goes, "You're going too fast." And I go, "No, I'm not." "Yeah, you're going a little too fast." And he'll go, "There's red lights ahead. There's brake lights ahead. You better slow down." And I mean, there are all these things he will point out that I will see, but it doesn't really register. So there's something positive to say about active passengers.
Yeah. I think it's also, Fran, a really great opportunity. Instead of, families doing their own separate thing, I think we've become a generation where, people will have the hands free. So they're talking on the phone. The kids are in the backseat doing their own thing. It's a really nice way to connect, I think, as a family in the car and talk about, like, what stands out to you and things like that. I kind of love the idea of encouraging your children to be active passengers, because it's another opportunity for them to feel like, oh, mom and dad want help while they're driving. This is very cool. And they don't even realize that they're learning. They're picking up really great habits. I wanted to remind folks also really quickly, Fran, what is your website? Because I know you have a lot of free online resources for parents to help with their kids before they become drivers, or if they have already become drivers, what they can kind of, like, refresher courses or things like that.
AAA's website is AAA.com. And, you'll have to go to the news and safety link on the top menu. But an even better website is put out by our national AAA office. It's called AAA Exchange, all together, AAAExchange.com. And it'll bring you to a website on various aspects of road safety. And you just Google teen driving, driving in general, and it'll bring you, a lot of articles. But there's an even better website, and I'll probably get hollered at for saying this, but I think it's a great website. It's called nationalpassengersafety.org.
NationalPassengerSafety.org. I am writing that down. That is fantastic. Well, I'm going to put this on the podcast later this morning. And if people want those websites, we'll make that available to them. But Fran, I think this, again, is a fantastic story out of Michigan. But I think it serves as an example, an extreme example, but one nonetheless, that even that could be a starting conversation between drivers and their kids for why it's great to be an active passenger. So I thank you, AAA, and folks like Cindy Iodice and the Flagman Campaign for continuing to put that message out there for whatever reason, whether it is slow down, move over laws, or just in general, creating safer drivers in the future, how important it is to be an active passenger. So I thank you for that message.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Welcome all the time. Fran Mako of AAA. We'll chat with her in a couple weeks right here on WICC.
Melissa in the Morning talks with career strategist and workplace expert Julie Bauke. It's Julie on the Job. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Apparently, there's a real skills gap. It's so wide that workers just can't keep up. This is a new report out of Fortune that Julie Bauke came across, sharing it this morning and giving us some insight into which skills employers find are the most important. Hey, Julie, welcome back. How are you?
Hey, good. So this whole AI thing sort of snuck up on us really fast.
And that really concerns me, because I hate it.
Yeah.
I hate it so much. I'm sorry. I really do. I'm just being honest.
So it didn't so much sneak up on us, because, people who are into that sort of thing have seen it coming for a long time.
Sure.
But I think the pace of it has just, in terms of how it has infiltrated so many jobs, so many industries, is what is, it's what's catching people off guard. And employers are looking forward saying, okay, what do we need moving forward? And I saw this really interesting stat that IBM has actually, they went through all of their open jobs and are cutting back or closing off the jobs in terms of, like, you know, which jobs they're going to continue to hire for that might have been open.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that they thought could be replaced by AI. And so when you combine that fact with, we still know that employers are having a hard time finding people, it makes sense that they would look for other alternatives. There are fast food restaurants. There are several McDonald's now that are, and other fast food restaurants that only operate with you know, some sort of robotic or AI sort of app or option or tool. From where you go through the drive-through to how the food's prepared and handed to you and how you pay. And so it's there are those pockets where it is one of those things that's already being used. And I think we know it's already being used. It's just it's going to be more widespread more quickly than we imagine.
Yeah. So tell us, Julie, when they say that there's a skills gap so wide, is that generational? Is that because we're talking about technological advances? Like, what are we looking at here, to be more specific?
So, okay. So remember, okay, you probably don't, but I very much remember the first time I got on the internet.
Oh, I do. We were just talking about this in the show. Oh, because I took typing classes when first brought out the computers. I was in sixth grade and the typing classes. That was classic. Are your feet planted on the floor? Like, it's so funny to think about it. Oh, yeah. I remember when the internet became a thing. Sure. Of course.
Yeah. But we were trying to figure out what it meant. People were wringing their hands. This is going to be the end of people, end of jobs. And a lot of the same concerns we have about security and the things we don't like about it are some of the same concerns we had about smartphones, as well as just being on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are at that beginning where we're trying to figure out what's this going to mean. But the pace of it is what is causing employers to say, well, wait a minute, we don't understand how we don't even understand how this is going to change, but we do know that it is coming at us quickly. And so it makes sense that employers would say, okay, when we need to hire now, we need people who, number one, have the desire and the ability and the energy to dive into it and figure it out, help us figure it out. And so, and the, you know, the open-mindedness, the desire to keep learning, the, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so they're already starting to say, now let's think about what we're going to need moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
Although we may not need it today, we're going to need it more quickly than we thought we were going to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, so when you look at, like, the jobs that are going to be replaced, a lot of those are things like working at fast food restaurants. They are customer service type positions where they can set something up that it has the ability to answer people's questions. They can predict based on what you type in or how you speak what your question is. And the more questions they answer, the more of a repository, shall we say, of answers they have. And so, you know, machine learning, whether it's something like ChatGPT or one of the other hundreds of tools that are already out there for a variety of uses, the desire to step into those, save money by using those, kind of cut down on labor costs, those are of great interest to employers. And so what they're saying is, we are going to need people to help us figure all this out, which is why this talk about we can't find the people that already know this stuff. It's like a chicken and an egg thing. You know, we can't find the people that already know it. And so I like to look at these things as an opportunity for those of us who, you know.
Well, and so we're talking to our career strategist, Julie Bauke. What I noticed about this list, which we can go through a little bit more in a second, Julie, is the top 10 skills, according to this article, they're sort of split for me, to be honest. So when you look at some of them, I think to myself, okay, this sounds like a younger generation worker. But then there are other ones that I think to myself, well, this would actually be better for a veteran worker. So, for sure. example, you know, like AI and big data, technological literacy, that to me sounds like a younger worker. But when you hear creative or analytical thinking, that could be either. Motivation, self-awareness, talent management, that to me is somebody who has a seasoned resume, has been working with people for a long time. Service orientation and customer service, that's another one that I feel like is more for the older demographic. They've dealt with hundreds of thousands of clients or customer review, you know, whatever it may be. So what's interesting about this is there's not one demographic actually in this list.
No, there isn't. You know,
but that's
what
good.
I would say the overarching skill, quality, mindset that employers need, and this is not dependent on age, profession, or industry, and that is a willingness to learn, an openness to try something new, an interest in, you know, kind of a sort of the opposite. And I've talked to people like this who said, well, you know, I'm not interested in that. I'm not going to learn that. I want a job where they don't need me to learn any of that.
Mm.
And that sets off warning bells, because that's really about someone who said, I give up. And believe me, as someone who's not, I mean, like I said, when I first logged on the internet, I was scared to death. And it's still not natural for me. You know, only the very youngest of us are digital natives. But you have to make that decision, and you have to say, I am committed to keeping up with what's going on. Now, it doesn't, so here's where it gets overwhelming. So there's a guy who I follow, who actually is a friend of mine. His name, he goes by AI Daddy. And he's on all the social media platforms. And even if you just Google AI Daddy, he has some amazing downloads he's put together, 600 plus tools, AI tools. And he has them organized by how they're used and where they're used.
Wow.
And so you don't have to go in and learn everything. I'm not a creative, so I don't need to go in and learn the tools that creative people use. So the break it down and say, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to poke around and figure out what my profession, maybe I'm an accountant, and my industry, maybe I'm in the insurance industry, maybe I'm in a financial services industry, and I'm a marketing person. So what is your profession, and what is the industry you find yourself in? And figure out, how are they using AI? What tools are they using? And just start there. I think we're not very good at telling what is real from what isn't. And this is only going to heighten that, which is the scary part. But at the same time, I mean, I keep trying to say, okay, we've done this before. I mean, who knew that someday everything we would do with our phone, and the thing we probably do the least, is actually make phone calls? You know, so it's like, you know, these things have to evolve.
Mm-hmm.
But the worst thing you can do, unless you are super close to retirement and you know you're never going to have to worry about this, is put your hands over your ears and say, don't talk to me about it. I don't want to know about it, because it is being used, and either some knowledge of it, but at the very least, the ability and willingness to learn new things, whether it is an AI tool or whether it is just, you know, a new customer, a new CRM, another customer management tool, or a new project tracker. You know, we all have experience learning new things, but I think because it happens so slowly, you don't realize it. You just kind of drip, drip, and pretty soon you know how to do something. And this has been said to be the biggest change in our world since, you know, the invention of the internet, or the advent of the internet. And so it is kind of scary. And the less techie you feel,
mm-hmm.
the more scary it's going to be. But like you said, it also creates opportunity.
Right.
You can go online. You can take a course. You can watch YouTube videos. You can start to understand what it is and how it might affect you and your world. The learning and the knowledge is at our fingertips in ways it never has been before. And so when you really start to think about it that way and say, okay, I'm going to do something easy, like do a poem or write a story, or go online and find a tool that can take what I've written and maybe write it in different ways and just try like that. I mean, I'm never going to be an expert, but in order to advise people on their careers, I do need to continue to develop, you know, an understanding of it that helps me do my job, but I don't have to learn how to use it for everybody's jobs.
Right.
And so I'm just saying, chunk it down. Don't, it's here. It's not going anywhere. And at the very least, if you're not going to become super really adept at it, you can develop your creative thinking skills. You can be flexible. You can be agile. You can be willing to learn. You can be all of those things. But it's also, look, if you are at the beginning of your career or even mid-career, and you're saying, you know what? I think I want a new career. It's time for me to change careers.
Right.
The opportunity here is
not matching what I want to do.
Because
yeah.
Aren't enough people out there who understand it. And so if you even develop a basic understanding and the ability to use it at a basic level, you have demonstrated something about yourself, that you don't wait for your company to mandate something, but you went out and embraced it yourself.
You're innovative.
And that's
right.
Really what companies are looking for.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And Julie, I'm glad that you identified this for a lot of our listeners. And I think it's something to really think about, whether you want to advance in your current career or even if you want to switch gears a little bit. There are so many resources out there where you can learn some of these skills and get ahead.
This AI daddy guy is really good. He explains it in ways that you can understand it. And so follow him on any of the platforms that are out there. He's just got really, really good information in a way that, you know, I, a baby boomer who is not very technical, never has been in a way that I understand. And so you've got to just start somewhere. And so in my opinion, that's where I started. And for me, that was a great place to start.
Julie, I really appreciate your help on this and each and every week. Thank you so much for yet again a really helpful Julie on the job here on WICC.